I'm sitting here with Dr. Richard Land, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. We're talking about apologetics, the defense of the faith. What are your most difficult questions?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is my distinct honor to have in the studio with me today Dr. Richard Land. He is president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, one of the nation's, one of the world's premier apologetic schools. He has a PhD from no less than Oxford University, served for 25 years as the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And right before the show, we're talking about robots and technology. Dr. Land, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Well, thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you.
Dr. Land, there's a whole lot we can talk about. The state of America, the state of the church, the defense of the faith, modern technology. But first, let's get to know you. For our listeners that aren't familiar with your ministry over the decades, I'm sure many, many are. But were you raised in a godly Christian home?
I was. I was raised in a Southern Baptist home. My mother was from Boston and was a Northern New England Baptist. My dad was from Texas and was a lost Methodist. Didn't know it, but he was lost. Got saved at a Billy Graham crusade.
Really?
At Rice Stadium in Houston, Texas, when I was 6 years old. And so I got to see my dad baptized and became a pillar of the church, deacon, and was my youth leader. And I was very privileged to be raised in a very very devout Southern Baptist home. Was called to preach when I was 16. And, you know, God's been good.
All right. So a question, though. You're called to preach Southern Baptist, but then you go to Princeton University, which is not known as a bastion for the faith. I mean, a century ago, maybe.
Yeah.
But, okay. And then from Princeton to Oxford University.
Well, I went to New Orleans Seminary in between.
In between, yeah.
Yeah, I went to Princeton and then went to New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary and got my master's degree, my MDiv degree. And then from there, went to Oxford and did a PhD.
And what did you focus on at Oxford?
It was in this country, it would have been historical theology. In England, they don't have historical theology, it's theology. But I focused on the theology behind the Puritan Revolution and ended up doing my dissertation basically on the differing concept of the church and its relationship to the state, which is the issue which broke the back of the Puritan Revolution, because they were united in what they wanted, which was to get rid of a king who wanted to rule by divine right and a state, an Anglican state church. But once they got rid of the Anglican state church, the Presbyterians wanted a Presbyterian state church. The Baptists and the Congregationalists wanted no state church.
Mm.
And Cromwell's army was about half Presbyterian and about half Baptist and Congregationalist. And so it was wrestling over that issue, which led to the collapse of the Puritan Revolution and the Restoration. And, you know, you would think that's pretty esoteric. But when I was, for 25 years, when I was head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, I kept dealing with the same issues, the nature of the church and what is the relationship it should have to the state and what relationship should it not have to the state. What does separation of church and state mean? It certainly doesn't mean the separation of religiously informed morality and public policy.
All right. So on my list of questions I want to ask you is that very one, separation of church and state. 30 seconds before the break, though, Oxford University, elite university worldwide, you are thinking, man, is it possible to love God with all your heart and all your mind at the same time?
Yes, sir. And, of course, C.S. Lewis, the spirit of Oxford, is living proof of that.
Yeah. So, friends, we're not going to turn off our brains today as we talk about God. But if you have questions, something you've struggled with in your own faith, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. Are you signed up yet for the Apologetics Conference, the nation's premier apologetics conference in October, right in North Carolina? Are you signed up yet? We'll tell you about that when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm sitting here with Dr. Richard Land, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. I have to say, Dr. Land, when I saw that you came on for that position, I was impressed that the seminary was able to get you, and I knew you were flying in 1,000 different directions, so to camp down here was tremendous. We were talking sports a little bit during the break, as Dr. Land was asking me where I'm from. It's in New York. We were talking about different teams. Growing up, Jewish home, New York City, then Long Island, I didn't know what Christian terminology meant. And I remember seeing scrawl on a wall in a New York City subway station where I'd go with my dad sometimes. It said, Jesus saves. Mm. Of course, I had no conception what that meant. So in the Jewish world, you had jokes. There was the business joke, Jesus saves, Moses invests. And then there was the bumper sticker in the height of the Boston Bruins dynasty with Bobby Orr and so on. And it said, Jesus saves, Esposito scores on the rebound. So we had no understanding of what these things meant. This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, spiritual revolution. Number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. We will take some calls. Dr. Land, separation of church and state. In American history, when does that concept come in via the Supreme Court, and why is it so critical that the church gets it right today? What are the extremes on either side?
Well, a revolution began in 1947 when the Supreme Court picked out a phrase out of context from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1802 to the Baptist ministers of Danbury, Connecticut. Now, what you have to cast your mind back and remember that at the time of our Constitution being accepted and our federal government being founded in 1789, 9 of the original 13 states had official tax-supported state churches that were organically united to the state, that were given preferential treatment by the state, and that discriminated to varying degrees against people who didn't belong to that state church. They were Episcopal churches in the South, they were Congregational churches in New England, and they were Presbyterian churches in the middle states. 9 of the original 13 states. In fact, in Virginia, there were 500 Baptist preachers who were thrown in jail over a 10-year period just prior to the Constitution being ratified for, quote, disturbing the peace. Now, that's not the worst definition of preaching I've ever heard, but that's what they were put in jail for, preaching without a license from the state to do so.
Wow.
And, of course, the Baptists said, we don't need a license from the state. We have a license from God, and the state shouldn't have anything to say about whether we preach the gospel and what gospel we preach. So the Baptist ministers in Danbury, Connecticut, were being discriminated against. Everybody in their congregation was having to pay taxes to support the Congregational State Church. And so they wrote to Thomas Jefferson and asked him what his position was on this. And he said that there ought to be a wall of separation between the church and the state. Now, that letter went through 3 drafts before he mailed it off, and He very consciously made the decision to say a wall of separation between the institution of the church and the institution of the state, not a separation of religiously informed morality from public policy. He never intended that. And his definition of separation of church and state was a little different anyway. I mean, after all, he was the architect of the University of Virginia, and there's a chapel on the quad of the State University of Virginia. And just a little bit of inside baseball, the morning that he wrote the final draft, the day he wrote the final draft of that letter, that morning at 10:30 in the morning, John Leland, a very famous Baptist preacher from the Great Awakening, came to the White House by prearrangement to present an 1,100-pound cheese that the Democrats of Western Massachusetts had created as a gift to Thomas Jefferson. And Leland assured Jefferson that no Federalist cows had contributed any milk to this cheese, just Democrat cows. he prayed for Jefferson, and then Jefferson took the cheese, went back in, had lunch, wrote the final draft, mailed it off on Friday afternoon. Sunday morning, Jefferson went to a worship service in the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. where John Leland preached a sermon from the speaker's rostrum of the House of Representatives. Jefferson had no problem with that, and there were weekly Christian worship services in the House of Representatives until the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, what Jefferson meant by separation of church and state was there shouldn't be an organic connection where the church, where the state favors one church over another. Now, what happened starting in 1947 is the Supreme Court turned that on its head and basically said that we ought to try to sanitize the public spaces from any religious expression, and that separation of church and state meant freedom from religion rather than freedom for religion, which is not what our forefathers understood. Was that the First Amendment, by the way, all the restrictions in the First Amendment are on the government,
mm-hmm.
not on you, not on me, not on your listeners. We can't violate the First Amendment. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law affecting an establishment of religion, nor interfering with the free exercise thereof. All the restrictions are on the government.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Supreme Court has done since 47 is consciously and unconsciously turn that on its head so that they now intend for it to mean freedom from religion. That's not what our government says. That's not what our Constitution says. It says freedom for religion.
Yeah, absolutely. And a few little details there of which I was prior to this completely unaware. So where we find ourselves today, on the one hand, there's the general hostility towards mm-hmm. God and religion in America. It's almost as if the seeds of the new atheists have been planted mm-hmm. and grown throughout the society. And then when the church is associated with, quote, homophobia mm-hmm. and the persecution of a minority, a bullied minority, mm-hmm. now we're made into these monsters. It feels like Psalm 2 to me, where the nations say, we don't want mm-hmm. God and his anointed one to reign over. So even though we're not talking about a theocracy, there is now this vocal mm-hmm. outcry, we don't want God, we don't want your Bible, we don't want your God. Mm-hmm. Of course, this would have been terribly foreign mm-hmm. to the founding fathers. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with the idea that the way America was founded, it presupposed that Americans would be a religious people?
No question. This is not open to debate. John Adams, who, along with James Madison, they were the chief architects of the Constitution. Jefferson was the chief architect of the Declaration. But by the time the Constitution came along, Jefferson was in France as ambassador. Adams and Madison were the chief architects of the Constitution. Adams, in 1798, serving as the second president of the United States, said, we have a government that is designed only for a moral and a religious people. It is insufficient for any other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he meant by that was that the only way that you can have a government that gives the degree of freedom that we have in this country, where the government really sort of treads lightly, is if the majority of the people obey the law because they are aware they're accountable to a higher authority than government. And so they obey the law whether anybody's watching or not. Once you have that belief taken away and people don't believe that they are accountable to a higher authority, namely God, then freedom becomes license. And license leads to chaos, and you have to have the government become ever more intrusive to ensure order.
Mm.
And that's what we've experienced in my lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm asking questions. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you saying they're not up for debate. Some people are unaware, and the questions
historically, are... Historically, this is not even... This is not... as Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late, great Democratic senator from New York, said, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Yes.
Well, the facts are that our country was founded as a nation on Judeo-Christian principles and Enlightenment ideas of self-government.
Yeah. Again... all you have to do is read the documents. I was looking at one study that was looking at all of the major writings of the founding fathers, anything relative to politics, the founding of our nation, and found that far, far, far and away, more than British law books and other things like that, far, far, far and away, the most quoted document was the Bible, about 34% of all identifiable quotes.
Have you ever wondered why there is such a synergy between the United States of America and the State of Israel?
Good question.
Because we are the two countries that were founded on the Bible and the principles of the Bible. The United States of America and the State of Israel were founded on a worldview that comes from Holy Scripture.
Yeah, and if that's presupposed, then you have, by presupposition, a moral people, a God-fearing people. All right, friends, we're going to come back and focus on the question of apologetics. Go to SES.edu, SES.edu, one of the nation's premier apologetic schools, with an upcoming apologetics conference. We'll tell you all about it when we come back.
Of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the line of fire. This is Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. I have in studio with me Dr. Richard Land, a wealth of information on many, many different subjects. Respected leader for decades among Southern Baptists and Christians nationwide, served on presidential commissions, and is currently president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. I have the joy of being an adjunct professor there as well. Dr. Land, we have a number of grads from our own ministry school that have gone on to SES, and then you have your own set of grads from SES, like Dr. Frank Turek. You've got a tremendous faculty there. I mean, devoted Christian men who are deep thinkers, and everyone that I know that's gone there has been really excited about the school. Before we talk about the larger question of apologetics, the upcoming conference, it's a premier event. I have the joy of participating in it most years as well. Tell us about the conference, when it's coming up. Folks come literally from around the country
be
there.
They do. People put it on their calendar. It's the longest running annual apologetics conference in North America. And the theme this year is ideas have consequences. The bigger the idea, the bigger the consequence. And we're going to be talking about some of those. And the one that we just talked about earlier about, you know, the idea that the Supreme Court turned separation of church and state on its head. You know, the great story about how they studied the world about 20 years ago, Gallup did, to try to determine the degree of religiosity or religious belief in different countries. They asked questions like, do you believe in the existence of a supreme being, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they found that Sweden was the least religious country in the world, and India was the most religious country in the world. America, by the way, was third most religious country.
Yeah.
And they told the great sociologist Peter Berger this, and he said, America is a nation of Indians ruled by an elite of Swedes. There's a lot of truth in that. There's a lot of truth in that. And the elites, which have been very secular, have their influence has now filtered down. The ideas have consequences.
Yeah.
This idea that you're supposed to, you know, somehow we've gotten the idea it's okay to say I'm a Marxist or I'm an atheist and therefore I believe thus and so. But it's not all right to say I'm a Christian and thus I believe thus and so. Or I'm an Orthodox Jew and thus I believe thus and so. And that's discrimination. That's discrimination against religion. And we have probably the most discriminated against group in the United States today are people who are have a traditional Judeo-Christian worldview.
Yeah, it's the truth.
And so what we do at our conference is we give people ammunition. You know, we bring in premier speakers like Hugh Ross and Josh McDowell and people like Michael Brown and others to talk about these issues and to give people the ammunition. That's what we do. You know, SES is the West Point of apologetics.
Yeah.
Our aim is to produce the MacArthurs and the Pattons and the Eisenhowers. You know, I'd use this analogy, and Frank Turek said, well, in the future, I want to be Patton. I said, okay, from now on, you can be Patton, not MacArthur, but Patton. My favorite's MacArthur, but, you know, we're the ones who produce the guys who go out there and fight the fight, and nobody is doing as good a job of doing what we do the way we do it. We provide people with, you know, okay, we can paint atheists and agnostics into a corner. There is an ultimate reality. You can know that ultimate reality, and that ultimate reality is revealed in God. And otherwise, you're committing intellectual suicide.
Yeah. And as I've had Frank Turek on my show, we've talked about his new book, Stealing from mm-hmm. God, mm-hmm. and others. I rack my brain trying to come up with answers to our premises, mm-hmm. and I really can't find solid answers. And I have very little scientific background. Mm-hmm. But when I discuss things with people scientifically mm-hmm. and just the origin mm-hmm. of the universe yep. or DNA, or well, they, what are they going to say?
Well, you know, ultimately, you know what they say. When you back them into a corner, if you've ever seen the movie Expelled, where Ben Stein corners Dawkins,
yep.
and, you know, he says, well, where's that come from? Or where's that come from? Or where's that? And finally he says, well, maybe aliens came from another galaxy and seeded life on this planet. And I'm going, he would rather believe in aliens from a foreign galaxy than the fact that there was a supreme being?
You know, I've given talks at, not an invitation of the university to do a faculty lecture, but Christian outreach groups, talks at Columbia and Yale on the origin of anti-Semitism, the diabolical nature of anti-Semitism, where I explain there's no rational explanation
That's right.
that connects all the dots. And I go through all of this, and I go through all of the potential explanations, and I show that nothing actually works, mm-hmm. and I field questions. The best answer that anyone gave to how anti-Semitism could be so widespread without a supernatural cause was that aliens were behind it. And then when I explained how that didn't work, he accepted that. But that was mm-hmm. the best anyone could come up with.
Well, there's no look, to me, there's no question about it. It's demonic. It's satanic. There's no rational explanation of 15 million people having generated this kind of animosity across history and around the world. It's the flip side of being God's chosen people. If you're going to be God's chosen people, you're going to be the subject of the special enmity of the evil one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, friends, here are the dates. October 16th. And 17th, this is going to be hosted at Calvary Church, Charlotte, North Carolina. And this event is a large event. It's got an unbelievable amount of things happening, from plenary sessions to workshops to attend. Gary Habermas from Liberty, premier scholar on the resurrection of Jesus. Josh McDowell is going to be there. Dr. Hugh Ross was just mentioned. Folks on the cutting edge of social moral issues in America. Tony Perkins. I'm going to be part of a panel discussion on redefining marriage and then doing a special book launch with my book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution. So go to ses.edu. That's Southern Evangelical Seminary. ses.edu, Seminary Bible College, Veritas Graduate School of Apologetics. Maybe you want to do further study. Dr. Lynn, we've got 2 minutes. Are there online classes people
Absolutely.
Can enroll in?
In fact, when I came here 2 years ago, 40% of our students were online. Now 80% of our students are online. And that's happening everywhere across the country. But we, you know, I've told the faculty and staff and the trustees, we're not going to swim against the tide. We're going to surf the wave. To me, internet education is God's gift. The devil's used the internet for his purposes. We're going to redeem it for God's purposes now. And so we have our bachelor's and master's programs, and to a significant degree, our doctoral programs are available online, both in real time and not real time, synchronous and non-synchronous, to use the academic language. We also have a lay institute, which we have reactivated, the Southern Evangelical Lay Institute, where, you know, people may not feel like they want to get into a degree program. That might be a little step too far for them right now. But we put it down on the bottom level, and, you know, so we have Norm Geisler's class as the first class. We have a professor come on and say, here's what Dr. Geisler's going to be talking about today. Then Dr. Geisler talks about it. Then the professor comes back and says, now this is what Dr. Geisler talked about today. And there are three courses in the basic lay certificate for $195, and then you can take the advanced certificate. And if you get interested in it and you want to then say, well, you know, I think I'd like to do a degree in this, there's a way in which you can go back and you can do additional work and you can upgrade the certificate and get degree credit for it.
All right. Excellent. Friends, there's something for you at Southern Evangelical Seminary. You may even take a course that I teach there as well. So go to ses.edu. And if you do enroll, just say that you heard about it on the Line of Fire radio broadcast. And the Apologetics Conference, join us from around the country, October 16th and 17th. Worth coming into Charlotte just for the conference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm sitting here with Dr. Richard Land, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, that is S-E-S-E-D-U. Dr. Land, the atmosphere at Oxford University, how does that compare with the atmosphere at our elite universities in America?
Well, actually, I found less hostility to traditional Christian faith at Oxford than I did at Princeton. And the reason is that at Oxford, in England, there really is no parallel Christian system of education. So if you're, you know, if you're a serious Christian, you if you're going to be involved in academics, you've got to be in the major universities. You can't, you don't have the option of going to, you know, a Christian university like Liberty. And so there were more Christians that I encountered, both in the faculty and the student body at Oxford, than was the case at Princeton, and they were less hostile. Mm-hmm. Princeton, when I was there, was very hostile to traditional Christian faith. It's less hostile now because of the influence of Robbie George and some of the people that he's helped to bring there as students and otherwise. But, you know, the most interesting thing to me was of the three places I went to school, the only place that I was actually actively persecuted for my faith was at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary.
For what?
Well, because I had professors who were moderates and who were liberals, and they wanted to liberate me from my prejudices and from my traditional Christian
faith. Narrow-minded fundamentalism.
Yeah, and, you know, yeah, they considered me to be a narrow-minded conservative who just needed to be liberated like they'd been liberated. And it was really sort of shocking. I mean, I found more tolerance and more acceptance at Princeton and at Oxford than I did at New Orleans Seminary.
Interesting.
Now, that's changed now, of course. New Orleans Seminary, because of the conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention, is very conservative and a great place to go now. But when I went there, I had professors who were putting question marks at the end of God's sentences from the very first day.
Isn't it like the children of Israel, that they wanted to be like the other nations and have a king, that sometimes in our insecurity as believers that we want to show the world we're just as smart and as light. And so that generally means we take the critical theories that are 20, 30 years old, introduce them as cutting edge, as opposed to this is the place where we should be diving into the word with faith and confidence.
Well, that's right. And I found that I did find a prevailing presumption that, you know, if you were really going to be intellectual, you were really going to be scholarly, that you had to accept a secularist mindset. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. We have more evidence for our beliefs and for our worldview than they have for theirs. There's no question about it. It takes a lot more faith to believe that there was not an intelligent designer of this creation. It takes a lot more faith to believe what Darwin believes than it does to believe what we believe.
Yeah, hence the
blind faith.
Yeah, the Geisler Turek book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist.
Absolutely right.
I once sat on a flight, short flight in the States. The gentleman next to me had a legal pad, writing. We got done, and I said to him, so you're a lawyer? He said, no, law professor, NYU. I said, oh, I did my PhD in Semitic languages at NYU. I said, but my dad was senior law assistant with New York Supreme Court. So we started chatting. Somehow faith came up, and he said, I'm a devout atheist. Mm. And I said to him, yeah, that's the right word to use because it takes a lot more faith to believe what you believe than
what
I believe.
It does. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, it takes more faith than I can even fathom to be an atheist. And it certainly takes more faith than the faith to be a Christian, to be an agnostic. I mean, you know, if you look at the creation just as it is, just think about the incredible design and balance of the human body. And if anything goes out of kilter, you know, an ingrown toenail, and everything gets out of whack, I mean, the idea that that could be by chance, and of course we have a speaker coming to speak at our conference, John Sanford, who has written a book called Genetic Entropy, and he shows that all of the scientific evidence is that the gene pool is going down, not up, and if that's true, Darwin can't be true.
Can't be true. We'll be right back with my guest, Dr. Richard Land.
Give us
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends, welcome back to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, 866-348-7884. Sitting with Dr. Richard Land, longtime head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission with Southern Baptist Convention, 25 years. Russell Moore is leading that now,
yes.
Correct? And constant news.
Listen, in that job, it's like a lightning rod. I mean, you know, you need to pray for anybody in that job because, I mean, it's a constant lightning rod.
Yeah, and these days, even more constant. All right. At the end of the last segment, we were talking about atheism, agnosticism. And here's a question that was posted on Facebook. When I asked, what's the most difficult objection to the faith you've ever had to deal with? Obviously, the problem of suffering is something that always comes up. There are different kind of universal ones. But a gentleman posted this. The sincere agnostic's humanist unbelief is truly difficult. Someone to whom the notion of God is plausible, but given all of the different versions of divinity and all of the different religious beliefs and cultural traditions, finds it intellectually and emotionally difficult to accept there is an objective truth about God. Getting these individuals whose lives are stable, prosperous, generally moral, and who produce good fruit as regards the way they interact with others and have good works is very difficult. Take Donald Trump, for instance. He never felt the need to repent and ask God for forgiveness. He's a great citizen, a moral man in general. Doesn't have any real vices. All right, I don't know at this part. Let's leave out Donald Trump from this for the moment. But someone who says, I don't have a problem with a belief in God, but you've got all these different religions, even within the church, you've got all these different denominations and Catholic versus Protestant, and there could be a God. You know, what makes one God better than another? And my life seems to be fine without God. My religious neighbor's no better off or worse off than I am. How do we respond to that?
Well, the way I would respond to it is the way C.S. Lewis responded to it, basically, which is that we need to separate Christianity from other religions. Because Christianity makes unique claims that God became man and dwelt among us. And, you know, this idea that Jesus is a great moral teacher, he said, that's nonsense. He said he either was who he said he was, the God incarnate, the Son of God, or he was a lunatic on the level with somebody who thinks he's a poached egg, or he was the greatest imposter and liar in history. Don't give me any of this nonsense about his being a great moral teacher, because he didn't leave that option open to us, because by everything that he said and everything that he did, he claimed to be God. He claimed the prerogatives of God, and he did so in a society which was hypersensitive to that. I mean, Jewish society in the first century, I mean, they understood when he said, I am who I am, they understood exactly what he meant. They thought he was preaching blasphemy because he was claiming to be God before Abraham was. I was. And he claimed to forgive sin. And he made these transcendent truth claims. And then he came back from the dead. And 500 people saw him at the same time. And the gospels were circulating in the place where these miracles took place and the resurrection took place during the lifespan of the people who would have been there, and there were eyewitnesses. If they could have disproved, if the Jewish authorities or the Roman authorities could have disproved the resurrection, they would have done so. They couldn't, because the resurrection happened. And everything that makes Christianity unique. All other religions are trying to reach up and reach God. Christianity says God reached down and came into contact with us. No man has seen God at any time. He is a spirit. But if you've seen the Son, you've seen the Father. He exegetes the Father, John chapter 1. So you have to deal with transcendent, unique truth claims that are made in the Christian faith, and they are either true or they are not true. And if they are true, then they alter reality, they alter existence, and they make all the difference for time and eternity.
All right, but what gives you such confidence that what the New Testament writers wrote is accurate? I mean, how do we know we actually have the words and deeds of Jesus? It seems like you're assuming a lot.
Well, the evidence for the historicity of the New Testament is unique among any books that existed prior to the invention of the printing press. We have over 5,000 copies or partial copies of the actual New Testament manuscripts, some of which date back to the early 2nd century. There's nothing like that in Roman history, nothing like that in Greek history, nothing like that in Jewish history. Prior to the invention of the printing press, there's nothing like it. And when you start comparing these manuscripts, you find that there's minute disagreement and nothing about anything essential to the faith. The only explanation for this kind of manuscript preservation is providential intervention, miraculous intervention, to have that degree of testimony to the truth. And then, of course, if you want to just do a logical argument, if there's one group of people that had to know whether or not Jesus came back from the dead, the apostles. Now, they spent the rest of their lives living lives of privation, of sacrifice, of being martyred for their faith, being boiled in oil, being crucified upside down, being beaten within an inch of their lives. There's no logical explanation for why they would do this for something they knew was untrue. The only explanation rationally and psychologically is they knew it was true because they had seen it and they had experienced it. And it transformed their lives. And if you look at the Apostle Peter before Pentecost, and you look at the Apostle Peter at Pentecost and after Pentecost, you understand the transformative difference that it made.
You know, it's an interesting phenomenon, but there is a famous Jewish teacher, probably the greatest Jewish leader of the 20th century, a man named Menachem Mendel Schneerson, known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, so the grand rabbi of the Lubavitcher sect of Hasidic Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews. He died at the age of 92 in 1994 and was widely hailed as the Messiah by his followers. He had a terrible stroke the last 2 years of his life. He was unable to communicate. That's when the Rebbe is Messiah movement almost went wild, based in Brooklyn. To this day, when you go in Israel, you'll see his picture all over, and it says Melech Mashiach, Melech HaMashiach, King Messiah there. So people said, well, look, here's a parallel. He died without completing his mission. His followers said, it's just a test for us. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you go to the grave, he's not there. It's just a physical test. We know he's really alive. We know he's completing his mission. Some talk about his return. Others were mortified, saying, you're just playing into Christian beliefs here. It's the same kind of thing. Well, here's what's interesting. People said, well, you have the same phenomenon where his followers claimed that he rose, and actually we know he didn't rise. But they believed it, and they're going on with zeal. But what's interesting is it's not the same phenomenon, because although the movement has actually doubled, or it's grown a lot since his death, which defies reason because you normally think you have to have a leader like this, the vast majority of his followers no longer claim that he was the Messiah. In other words, whatever the theology was, it adjusted to the fact that it didn't play out as planned. Whereas ours would be not just cognitive dissonance, but mass hysteria and an unprecedented level. I mean the cure, the atheist cure is worse than the disease. The explanation is more crazy.
Well, and if you think about it, too, I mean, I'm assuming that these people who are claiming that he's really alive are not being crucified.
Exactly.
They're not being boiled in oil. They're not being stoned. That's what happened to the Christians. And they continued to say, yes, he is risen. And then, of course, how else do you explain the Christian faith? I mean, you know, this is this Christian faith that came out of Judaism, and by 70 AD, by the fall of Jerusalem, it's estimated there were 20,000 Gentile Christians for every Jewish Christian because it just went into the Roman Empire and it exploded. The only rational explanation is that it was true. You know, I think about one of my old professors, Eugene Genovese, who was, when I had him, was a Marxist. He was the world's greatest living authority on slavery. Mm-hmm. He ended up, near the end of his life, coming back to the Catholicism of his youth. When I read one of his books called The Southern Front, I could actually see it happening. And he said, you know, the most difficult thing for me to explain as an atheist is the survival and the flourishing of the black church. He said, I look at the privation that African Americans have undergone as slaves. And you know, I'm the world's greatest living expert on slavery. And he said, I understand what was done to these people. And the fact that the black Christian church has survived and flourished, I can't explain it. As an atheist, I cannot explain it. Well, the reality is because they truly had the Lord Jesus Christ in their hearts. And you look at the result of Charleston versus Ferguson and Baltimore.
Yeah.
Charleston was the Christian response. You love those who hate you and persecute you, and in doing so, you transform things.
Yeah, the supernatural explanation of Christianity is the only rational explanation. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise. I'm sitting here with an incredibly eloquent, clear-thinking colleague, Dr. Richard Land, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. Have you wanted to take classes and get further in your academic education, get further in defense of the faith, get further in answering questions about God and the scriptures, maybe philosophical questions, scientific questions? Well, I know of no better place to study than Southern Evangelical Seminary. You say, yeah, but I don't live in North Carolina. Fear not. 80% of their students are online students now, classes in real time or taken at on your own schedule. I've taught some of the classes there in real time as well for folks studying online, and it's the same experience really as being there. But go to ses.edu to find out more. There are entry-level classes that are not towards a degree at the most basic level. There are classes in the bachelor's program, master's program, and even some in the doctoral program. ses.edu, their annual apologetics conference, the longest-running apologetics conference in North America, October 16th and 17th. I'll be there, God willing, of course, Dr. Land, many others. And Dr. Land, I see that Josh McDowell is presenting a Torah scroll to SES. How in the world did that happen?
Well, I'm going to have Eric Gustafson in the studio with us here. Eric, tell him how that happened.
We didn't set up the mic there, so we'll just get you over. Eric is at SES and coordinating a lot with the conference.
And a student.
Go ahead. Get real close there.
Well, anybody that's been to our conference in the last few years knows that Josh McDowell has done quite a bit of work on the authenticity of the biblical manuscripts and partnering with a philanthropist collector family. And this family wants to donate a series of scrolls, original scrolls. This is not a replica. This is an actual artifact to a small number of institutions that they feel will preserve their importance. So they'll be presenting it to Dr. Land.
Yeah, and of course, Josh has been talking a lot recently about this paper mache, these artifacts that were from the first and second century that were they were made of paper mache, and the paper mache was made from manuscripts, and they're beginning to be able to unravel these things to reconstitute them,
wow.
and the potential in terms of the evidence for the textual transmission is almost incomprehensibly strong.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
There's always more that's being discovered, just like the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's right.
Because the oldest manuscript we had, complete manuscript of the Hebrew Bible, mm-hmm. was a so-called Leningrad manuscript. Yeah. B19A was how it was numbered. So that's about 1,000 years old at present. And then the one considered the most accurate, the Aleppo mm-hmm. Codex, that was somewhat damaged mm-hmm. around the war with the independence of Israel. But in any case, the B19A manuscript, mm-hmm. that was the one. So, okay, how accurate? So how fascinating now to find scrolls at Qumran over 1,000 years old. And that's
first century BC, St. Mark's Isaiah scroll, and it's almost exact.
Yeah, so when you have some with the Masoretic textual tradition, letter for letter, the same. And what happened was the scribes preserved things with remarkable accuracy. Mm-hmm. The main changes you have are spelling changes, like British spelling of color versus American spelling of color, where a letter would drop out, but the exact same word. In some case, letter for letter for letter. But what would happen is the scrolls were basically buried or put in what was called the Geniza storage room in the back of a synagogue. So they, it's not that you had a gap and someone just created this text 1,000 years later.
That's right.
And yet, you know what's so crazy, though? That the talking points of the world, or that the Bible we have, it's based on unreliable manuscripts and translations of translations. Newsweek let me write a response to Kurt Eichenwald when he had that hit piece around Christmas last year.
Terrible.
It was terrible. So that Newsweek let me write a response that was longer than his initial article. But the idea that it's translations of translations based, what are people even talking about? It just doesn't even make sense.
Well, it's ignorance and also false information that's been put out because people, you know, fallen man really does not want to believe the scripture.
Yeah.
Because fallen man wants to be his own God. You know, Aldous Huxley admitted this.
Yeah.
Aldous Huxley said the reason we accepted evolution as true was not because of the scientific evidence, but because it interfered less with our sexual practices. In other words, if we are just evolved animals, then there's no guilt to us acting on our sexual urges. And it's interesting that it was the social sciences that accepted Darwinism first. It was not the hard sciences. It was the social sciences who wanted to believe this. I mean, after all, since Satan himself, what got Satan in trouble? He wanted to be God. He wanted to be his own God. And so he revolted against God. When he confronted Jesus in the wilderness, he said, I'll give you all the kingdoms of this world if you'll just bow down and worship me.
Yep.
This desire to be our own God. And what did he say to Adam and Eve? You eat of the fruit of this tree and you'll be like God. That's a tremendous temptation to people who are fallen Christian, fallen. If they're fallen in their fallen nature, they're self-centered. They worship the Holy Trinity of I, myself, and me. They want to be their own God. Now, I had this brought home to me in very powerful terms when I was a young father. My five-year-old, my oldest daughter, my sweet little Princess Jennifer Rebecca Sweetheart Supergirl, we had a special relationship. And we're singing, the King is coming, the King is coming, praise God, the King is coming. And so she said, well, Daddy, what's a king? And my wife said, well, honey, a king is somebody who tells you what to do. And without missing a beat, she said, well, I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. And I thought, there it is.
There it is.
The sweet little five-year-old girl, there's the sin nature. I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. I want to do what I want to do.
I remember sharing the gospel with a professor I had at Queens College in New York City, Queens, New York. Mm-hmm. And it was an archaeology class. I was sharing the gospel with her. And she said to me, she looked at me, she said, I'm not willing to abdicate the throne of my heart. I thought, at least she understands.
Well, that's, you know, that's self-awareness.
Yeah.
That's self-awareness.
All right, friends, Southern Evangelical Seminary, can't recommend the school highly enough, ses.edu, and check out the Apologetics Conference, October 16th and 17th. It is worth traveling into North Carolina. Normally, people from as many as 40 states, maybe even more, will be at the conference. And, of course, from all over North Carolina, I'll be participating. A couple of events I'll be part of as well. But some of the premier apologetic speakers in the world will be there. So check it out, ses.edu, October 16th, 17th. If some of you can't make it for the conference but want to continue your education online, check out the school, check out the classes, check out the options, full degree programs, or just, hey, I want to go a little further. I want to be able to answer basic questions. It's all there for you. And be sure, friends, to visit my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Check out this week's special resource offer and check out my latest articles. My bottom line today, God made us thinking, rational creatures. And to follow him, to believe in him with all of our heart, does not mean shutting off our mind and turning off our rational faculties. I'm sitting here with Dr. Richard Land, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. We're talking about apologetics, the defense of the faith. What are your most difficult questions?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I just had a terrific conversation the last hour with Dr. Richard Land. For 25 years, he headed up one of the key divisions of the Southern Baptist Convention, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Convention Commission. Excuse me. He also served at the invitation of former President Bush to serve on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And then recently has been asked to do something that is the most fascinating of all, which we'll come to, robots, technology, ethics, where is that going? Dr. Land is currently president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. Friends, if you live anywhere in North Carolina, but anywhere on the planet, really, but within America, I want to personally invite you to join me at the annual Apologetics Conference. It's October 16th and 17th. Folks literally come from around America. As I've given talks there, I've been amazed at how many different locations are represented. It's a who's who list of top Christian intellectuals, top apologists, practical sessions teaching for all members of the family. And Southern Evangelical also has a massive online degree program. Go to ses.edu to find out more. Dr. Land, welcome back for hour number two.
Well, thank you. And you know, one of the things that I was stunned by when I came to the seminary and went to the first conference was how many young people were there. I mean, school age people brought by their parents.
Yeah.
A lot of homeschool parents bring their children. And they. I remember Richard Howe was talking about the problem of evil. And I was up there, I introduced him, and I'm watching this father, and he's got what is probably a 12-year-old daughter on one side of him and about a 14-year-old daughter on the other side of him. And all three of them are taking notes like mad as Richard Howe's giving this wonderful presentation on the problem of evil and the answer to the problem of evil. And so I would encourage homeschoolers to think about bringing their young people and their students. I mean, this is, for anybody, you know, sixth grade and up, it's certainly, they'll be able to benefit from it. And we also, in our part of our program, we have dual credit. We have 12 hours of dual credit. So you can take a course for credit in high school, and it's also 3 hours of credit in college. And we have a four-course package. Starts out with Dr. Geisler's Introduction to Apologetics, then a course by me on the Bible and moral issues, then one on world religions, and then one on Christian doctrine. And it's really there to sort of inoculate Christian young people and get them, if they're going to go to a secular college like UNC Chapel Hill, we want to inoculate them. We want to vaccinate them with Christian truth before they go.
Before
they,
Professor Bart Ehrman
gets to them.
That's right.
And they get 12 hours of credit in order to do so. And they can look up that online at ses.edu. And the conference is conference.ses.edu. We'd love to have them. And we want to serve the homeschool community.
Yeah. And friends, when I heard Dr. Josh McDowell, in fact, it was at Dr. Land's installation. We were all in our PhD garments. The Oxford one was very cool. It's cooler than my NYU one.
The great story behind that. The first time I wore it, we had one of the professors at Criswell College. His wife said, "Well, Richard, I at least expected you to leap tall buildings at a single bound because it does look a little bit like Superman."
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. But anyway, Josh McDowell said that the objections that he was running into. Mm-hmm. With 19, 20-year-olds in college, he's now running into 13, 14-year-olds through internet.
Yeah.
So great conference for the whole family. Go to ses.edu. We come back. I want to throw a bunch of I'm not even going to tell you what they are, sir.
Okay.
Some random questions
all
about
right.
America out to Dr. Richard Land. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Just got asked a question by Dr. Land right before the break. So, not knowing all my personal testimony, I was not raised in a Christian home as you were. I was a heroin-shooting, LSD-using hippie rock drummer.
Wow.
I raised in a conservative Jewish home on Long Island. My mom and dad happily married, but I started playing drums when I was 8, so it's 1963. The Beatles came to America, 64. Time of real upheaval. Even though I was raised in a good home, mm-hmm. even though I, you know, went to synagogue here and there, high holidays, that kind of thing, nominally Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed at 13. Was a typical kid at that point, typical, you know, playing sports, playing games with my mm-hmm. friends, going to school, not getting into any trouble. Well, I went to see my first rock concert at 13 mm-hmm. years old, so Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. The Jimi Hendrix Experience, and it was an experience.
Yeah.
And the whole rock culture, I was really into it. I wanted to be like the rock stars. When someone offered me pot at 14, mm-hmm. I started getting high. And lo and behold, I had a very high tolerance to drugs, so normal drugs didn't do anything for me. So very quickly, I was doing harder drugs. By the time I was 15, shooting heroin. I had the nickname Drug Bear and Iron Man because I could take in more drugs than anybody in my school and survive. And being a stupid teenager, I thought that was a cool thing. And was decadent, full of rebellion, anger, pride. And my two best friends got wonderfully born again. They started going to a little church because the girls they liked were going there. The girls were going there because their dad had been praying for them. Their uncle was a pastor. And interestingly, it was a Pentecostal church, so they were fascinated by talk about healing and demons and stuff. But then the church was also dispensationalist, so they taught a lot about the end times. So we thought that was really cool. I mean, Book of Revelation and visions, and now a beast coming out of the bottomless pit with seven heads and ten horns. That's what we saw when we were hallucinating. So we thought this is really cool. But then God started to get hold of us. When I saw my friends change and started to turn away from the way we were living, I went to pull them out, and God got hold of me. And I was wonderfully born again in late 1971 at the age of 16. And then, of course, my dad said, great to see you off mm-hmm. drugs, but we're Jews, we don't believe this. Introduced me to the local rabbi. And he's the one that brought me to meet other rabbis and challenged me, if you don't know Hebrew, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean anything. So hence, that was my academic initiation. And I was kind of thrown into the ocean to learn to swim, because I've memorized thousands of verses from the King James. I love the Lord, spent hours with him. But in terms of the ability to deal with these brilliant rabbis with centuries of objections, mm-hmm. that was challenging. And that's why I felt I had to understand these things and be able to address them. And then my wife, Nancy, also Jewish, she was a hardcore atheist when we met at the age of 19. Her mom married four times, and she had concluded when she was 8 years old, it would be wonderful if there was a God. It's a shame there isn't. And when I met her, religion was for the weak people. And what opened her heart, amazingly, was the reality of personified evil. Mm. One day, it's just the light went on. She looked at the world and somehow realized that there is real evil in personified form. Therefore, there is a God.
Yeah.
And then God opened her heart. All right, Dr. Land, I just want to throw out some random things for you.
Okay.
Your thoughts on the Iran deal.
I think it's a catastrophe. I think it's a catastrophe. I think that it will be looked back upon if it goes through and America agrees to it. We will look back on it like Munich, at the very least, mm-hmm. like Munich, because it is naive. It fails to comprehend that Iran is evil. That the people who run Iran are evil. They're religious fanatics. Even deterrent doesn't work against them. We're going to give them enormous amounts of money to fund more terrorism. They've been the central banker for terrorism since 1979. And it'll start a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, which is the last place in the world you want a nuclear arms race. Because if the Shia Iranians have an atomic bomb, then the Sunni Saudis and the Egyptians and the Turks are going to want their own atomic bombs. And it's probably the place in the world that's most likely to use them mm-hmm. if they have them.
Yeah.
And it's an existential threat to Israel. I mean, these people have made it very clear that they admire Hitler, they admire Himmler. They say we can do what the Nazis failed to do because the Jews are all in one place. You know, one atomic bomb could kill 4 million Jews, which is probably true, considering the population concentrations around Tel Aviv. And these people really mean what they say. I mean, you have, you know, I remember when I was in high school, I was in a special honors program in civics, and we were reading original documents like the Communist Manifesto. We read Mein Kampf. And I kept asking my parents, didn't anybody read this book?
Mm.
I mean, he published this book in 1925, and everything he was going to do, he says in the book.
Yeah.
And my mother said, well, people read it, but they just thought he was a nut. Well, he was a nut, but he got control of a country, and he almost conquered the world, and he started a war that killed over 70 million people, including 6.5 million Jews who were the subject of genocide. And none of that should have been a surprise. I think the only reason that this deal is getting any kind of credence is the extent to which moral relativism has engulfed the United States. I'm convinced, Michael, that one of the things that happens when you become a moral relativist, you lose the ability to recognize and comprehend evil.
Mm.
And so you just don't think anybody could be that bad.
Right.
Well, guess what? Sometimes they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've seen these recent studies, these recent stories about ISIS, the theology of rape, that they, you know, these ISIS fighters are praying before they rape women, and then they're raping them, and then they're praying afterward. And they are saying that Allah says it's okay to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
That is evil personified on steroids.
In Iran, it was widely reported, let's say a woman was sentenced to death, but she was a virgin. Well, you can't put her to death, so what's the godly solution? Mm. You rape her first. So some ayatollah would come in, some leader, rape her. I mean, this is what was widely reported. But you can believe this, the extraordinary rationalization. So when we hear from Secretary of State Kerry, to paraphrase, when Iran says death to America, they don't really mean it. They must be laughing as they watch from Iran.
Oh, they hold us in. They hold our government in contempt, and I don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want you to remind me when John Kerry was ever right. Since the Vietnam War onward, John Kerry and Joe Biden have been wrong about virtually every foreign policy decision made by the United States since they've been in Congress and in the Senate. John Kerry and with a shepherd like that who needs wolves, and they are delusional in thinking that they can house train Iran. The people who run Iran are religious fanatics, at least as crazy as the people who ran Nazi Germany, maybe more so.
Yeah.
And because at least the Nazis were concerned about self-preservation, these people believe, they really believe, that if they bring about Armageddon, it'll bring the return of the 12th Iman and a worldwide Islamic caliphate. So deterrence doesn't work.
Yeah. And you even have the reported theology of ISIS that they know they're going to lose, mm-hmm. What they're going to do is draw everyone mm-hmm. into a final war, and by losing, somehow they
bring
win.
About Armageddon. Yeah. And Armageddon is not a final for them. It's not Armageddon. It's a prelude to the return of the 12th Iman and a worldwide caliphate. When you're dealing with that degree of religious delusion, deterrence and rationality don't work. But I think this deal is a catastrophe for the United States. They're going to leave alone the intercontinental ballistic missiles they're developing so that when they do get an atomic bomb, they can deliver it to New York and Charlotte and Detroit. This deal guarantees that there'll be a significant war, maybe involving nuclear weapons, within the next decade.
And the president saying, yeah, I understand that the $150 billion they'll be getting, that they're going to use a lot of that for terrorism. 1 minute.
And they're ignoring the fact that our courts have awarded a good deal of that money to the victims of Iranian terrorism. They're going to instead send it by executive fiat to the mullahs.
Amazing. All right, 30 seconds. What is driving President Obama to do this?
since he's been in office. Remember in 2009, when he first came into office, the Iranian people tried to revolt against their own government, and they were holding up signs in English. Who were they appealing to? They were appealing to us.
Yes.
And we totally and completely ignored them, because the president came into office believing that he was going to flip the entire Middle East by bringing Iran, making Iran our ally. And who can resist his charm? Who can resist his blandishments? I mean, this guy is a narcissist on steroids. He always believes he's the smartest guy in the room. He always believes he knows more than anybody else, and that no one can be immune to his charm.
You've heard it from the lips of Dr. Richard Land, who does not pull punches. I'll be right back. I've got a bunch more questions. We got to talk about presidential politics, Supreme Court decision, and post-Christian America. Is there a pathway back, or do we want to go back? All that with Dr. Richard Land. We'll be right back.
Of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us today on the Line of Fire. This is one of those days where I just get to sit back and have fun, and my guest does all the work. He is Dr. Richard Land, currently president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, that is SES.edu. And a reminder, especially for all of you, our great listeners all over North Carolina, join me. You have my personal invitation and Dr. Land's personal invitation. Join us October 16th and 17th, the 22nd Annual National Conference on Christian Apologetics. Dr. Land, some scientists who are going to be there.
Well, Hugh Ross is going to be there, and John Sanford. John Sanford, as I said earlier, wrote this book called Genetic Entropy. And he's he has a doctorate in genetics. And he shows in the book, scientifically, the scientific evidence is overwhelming, that instead of mutations leading to upward progress, mutations are almost always bad and often fatal, and that the genetic entropy, the genetic gene pool, is going downward, not upward and not neutral. It's going downward.
So we're devolving,
not
evolving.
And that, you know, even with genetic engineering and sort of moving around the edges, it's like rust on a car.
Mm-hmm.
The car is eventually going to rust out. And, of course, this fits with the second law of thermodynamics, that, you know, everything is devolving. Entropy is there, and it's there in the universe. It's there in the gene pool of human beings.
Got it. Any philosophers that are going to be speaking?
Well, we've got...
Let's see here.
We've got Norm Geisler, of course. I mean, after you talked about Norm Geisler, who else do you need to talk about?
Right, right.
We've got Ryan Anderson coming, who's written this new book that's coming out.
Number one young scholar.
Oh, yeah,
on
absolutely,
yep.
Solid. And Richard Howe's going to be speaking. And Jay Richards is going to be speaking about libertarianism and Christianity. Of course, Jay is just spot on when it comes to philosophy and to how it relates to economics and human nature. And we've got Fuzz Rana and Hugh Ross speaking. Frank Turrett's going to be speaking. We're going to have every field well covered.
Hey, listen, when Josh McDowell's there, when he presents the Torah School, if you ever need a Jew to do a reading from the Torah School,
right,
you got your local.
Okay.
You got your local.
All right, we'll do it.
Local Jew to help. Okay. Francis Schaeffer in the 80s was talking about America being post-Christian.
Yeah.
Of course, we've seen it in Europe. First, what does it mean for America to be post-Christian? Second, do we want to go back or do we want to go forward? What's the solution?
That's a great question, and it's one that I've thought a lot about and I've been asked about. You know, Schaeffer talked about in the 70s and 80s that America was operating out of a Christian memory, that we really had lost a real Judeo-Christian input into our culture, but we were still operating out of a Judeo-Christian memory and mindset of values,
mm-hmm.
That we sort of in the third person objectively believed there was a right and there was a wrong. You know, we hadn't been engulfed yet by moral relativism. Now, we might disagree in the 60s and 70s. There were a lot of disagreements about what the moral absolutes were, but we at least believe there were moral absolutes. But we have now, and let's not talk about a perfect past. I mean, look, I was born in 1946. I remember the 50s. I remember the 60s. Now, frankly, on the whole, better place to be a teenager, better place to be a kid in the 50s and 60s than today. But we need to recognize there was tremendous racism, there was mm-hmm. tremendous sexism, and there was a lot of hypocrisy. People who publicly lived Christian lives,
right.
but privately didn't, because there was enormous amount of social pressure. You know, I mean, if you got a divorce in the 60s and 70s, you probably didn't get the promotion at work.
Yeah.
You might even be ostracized by your own families. Now, I mean, there are no standards. The new standard is there are no standards. So everybody does that. We have the days of the judges. Everybody does that which is right in their own eyes. And you know, John Donne said, you know, no man is an island. We're all part of the main. Well, guess what? Now every man is his own island with his own dictionary, with his own definition of words, with his own definition of truth, and his own moral system, and his own moral values. And so we're atomizing. We're atomizing so that we have no connectedness. And, of course, the Bible tells us that it's not good for man to be alone. So God, you know, because God created us as fellowship creatures, to fellowship with him and to fellowship with each other. And when children, for instance, are deprived of human contact, they don't function very well.
Yeah.
When we're deprived of human contact, we begin to malfunction. And I think that's what's happening. But do we want to go back to the 50s and in the early 60s? No. We want to go forward to a place that we've never been, a place where we have Judeo-Christian values, which are the standard for our culture, and we actually live those values, and we understand that this says that racism is wrong. And sexism is wrong. And we have a more just and equitable society based upon those values. I've actually written a book about this based on a takeoff on John Lennon's song, Imagine. You know, he's the anthem of atheism. Imagine no heaven above us, no hell below us, no religion, no possessions, just a brotherhood of man. Interestingly enough, he couldn't sustain that. You know, the very next, that album that song is on, the very next song on the soundtrack is, you can wash your face, comb your hair, put on new clothes, but what you can't hide is when you're hurting inside.
Mm.
So even Lennon couldn't sustain it, because it's not sustainable apart from a relationship with God. But we, you know, so I talk about in this book, Imagine a God-blessed America, how it could happen and what it would look like. Well, what would it look like if we, you know, God has blessed our country. What if we had a heal the land kind of blessing? 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people, which are called by my name, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and forgive their sins and heal their land. What would happen if we had that kind of a revival, that kind of an awakening, where we turn from our sin and we repented and we reach that divine tipping point and God leans over from heaven and pours out a heal the land kind of blessing on the United States. Well, we'd be shutting down prisons and turning them into recreational facilities. Mm. We'd be shutting down counseling centers. We'd be shutting down child abuse centers. Divorce lawyers would be being retrained for new work. Illegitimacy would be rare. Abortion would be even rarer. Child abuse would be down. Sexism would be down. Racism would be down. In every way possible, we'd be a better society and a more just society, and certainly a safer and healthier society for children.
Yeah, and what that underscores so brilliantly is that God's ways are ways of life. That God's ways work in that That's sense, right. Because he is the designer. And while it's not about us, it's about him. When we do things his ways, it does bring life. Just right. Like the person that does not drink alcohol is not going to get cirrhosis right. of the liver. The person that doesn't smoke cigarettes, less likely to get lung cancer. And if you don't text while driving, you got a better chance of surviving right. that drive. The same way on the macro level. Mm-hmm. That's one of the theses of my book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, that gay activism has within itself the seeds of self-destruction, but God's ways are lasting. We'll be right back. Shake the nation, change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us. This is your listener-sponsored voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, Michael Brown, in studio with Dr. Richard Land, who is the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. And when I found out he was available for 2 hours, I said, well, take 2 hours. We could have 20 hours to talk or 200 hours to talk and just keep pushing buttons and getting lucid, clear-headed, biblically-based answers. I want to grab some phone calls. I haven't taken any. We're 90 minutes into our broadcast today. I want to take some calls and then let you know about some upcoming events at Southern Evangelical. And yes, we will still talk robots before we are done. We'll start in Cary, North Carolina. Eric, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you for your program. God bless you, Dr. Land. I'm going to be a little intemperate right now. I want to mention that there's different levels of scolding Christians for missing the mark. And rather than a reproof, I want to make a rebuke of any Christian that watches television. And that's all.
All right. So, Dr. Land, how would you respond to that broad-based rebuke?
Well, I plead guilty. I'm a child of television. I grew up with the Peanut Gallery and Howdy Doody. And I watch more television than I should. It's a source of constant prayer. I'm a huge watcher of Fox News and the Turner Classic Movie Channel. I'm a huge old movie buff. And so the American Movie Channel and Turner Classic Movies I watch. I think most of us should watch less television than we do. It's a very passive medium. Studies have been done that show if you sit in a quiet room and you listen to radio for an hour, and you sit in a quiet room and you watch television for an hour, you burn 30% less calories watching television.
Really?
Because at least with radio, you have to furnish your own mental images.
Interesting.
It's a very passive medium, and as I said, I watch more television than I should, and I try to monitor it. I try to be a better steward of my time. But, I don't think I'd go as far as our caller does, but I think his point is that we need to constantly be monitoring our time. Time is the most valuable commodity that we have as human beings. Once we spend it, it's gone. And I think too often we don't think about what is the wisest and best use of that time that once it's spent, it's gone.
Yeah, you never spend a quality hour with God and regret it. You spend an hour doing a lot of other things, regret it. And of course, there is also the extraordinary pollution that comes through the media, the brainwashing, the propaganda that we're being fed, the desensitizing to violence, to sex, to other things like that.
Well, and if you go to other countries, for instance, I've lived in Europe for 3 years in England, and you go to other countries, we are... Our entertainment media is very violent, and when people from other countries sort of notice it, that we have a sort of a pornography of violence.
Yeah, plus a pornography of pornography.
Of course, the Europeans have that too.
Right.
Probably worse than we do, but we do have a pornography of violence. And I remember Gorbachev once saying, "You have to be very careful with the Americans because their first solution to any problem is to shoot it."
Yeah.
And there's probably a grain of truth in that.
Yeah, and in fact, when some of our movies go overseas, we can have more of the sex scenes that we couldn't have in America, but we have to cut some of the violent scenes. Yeah. It's true. So Eric, I appreciate you saying that. Let's quote from Jacob, chapter 1, where we are exhorted to do two things, to demonstrate true religion, to care for the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. So whatever we need to do to keep ourselves unspotted from the world, we need to. We come back. I want to get to Sarah Dawood. You're up next. Stay with us.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH. If you've got a question for my guest, Dr. Richard Land, or a comment, let's go to Sarasota, Florida. Sarah, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
First, let me just say it's just a delight to be able to speak with you. You are such an encouragement. You know, you are just, you yourself are brilliant, and you're a brilliant light. And it's just a, I really am encouraged by your programming. You know, I told the screener I'm really interested in talking about Target. Is that, I'm not sure if that's related to your guest. Is that still okay to talk about?
Oh, absolutely. Dr. Land is on the front lines of moral and cultural issues, has been for decades. So first, Sarah, thank you for the very kind words. It's very sweet of you. Regarding Target, just so our audience knows, I referenced this yesterday as well, but Target has said that in response to some customers, which has to be a tiny minority, they're removing gender distinctions as much as they can through the store. So right now, you're still going to have men's clothing, women's clothing, although who knows what's going to happen with that. But, for example, if you go through the toy aisles, you're not going to have a divider like boys' toys, girls' toys, things like that. It's just genderless because the gender binary is an evil in society that we have to overcome. So that's what you wanted to address. Yeah, go ahead.
I do. You know, and I think there are differences between men and women. And I think those are largely biologically based. You know, we were created male and female in God's image. So those distinctions are really important to me. However, I actually don't have a problem with what Target's done. And the reason for that is I think our culture has, I think focusing on Target can take our eye off the ball. And the reason being, I think our culture has not defined male and female the same way as maybe we would want to in the kingdom of God. For instance, girls are hyper-sexualized in our culture. So I'm a mom. I have both girls and boys. And when it's my daughter's birthday, it's very difficult because I go to Target and I see pink aisles with Barbies and princesses that are hyper-sexualized and are not things that I want my daughter to aspire to. I want her to understand her womanhood and her girlhood as full expression of her human being and not just her sexuality. And so I'm often looking in the quote-unquote boy aisle for Legos and they have even like little robots, science experiments, things like that. And just even in the larger conversation in our culture about men and women, it makes me very sad when I see people who want to change their biology, right? So men who want to change their biology to become women. And sometimes I want to ask them, what is it that you feel you cannot do in the body you have? And I think that that gets into our culture because I do think that there are some negative, like macho male stereotypes, right? So I think we should have men who can be in a male body and be sensitive or be a tailor or be a dancer. I don't think that, so sometimes I think people want to change their biology or change their gender because they think that they can't express.
Right, you can't be a You can't be a tough girl. You can't be a sensitive guy. So, Sarah, I appreciate what you're saying, that the gender distinctions are often done in exaggerated ways, but more importantly, in hypersexualized ways. It's like I think of our my daughters who are in their 30s, or now our oldest granddaughter is a teenager, 14 years old. You know, you go shopping for clothes and all the jeans are a certain style, you know, low cut or things. And there's a certain image and you check out of a grocery store for decades. You're confronted with all of these hypersexualized images of women. So, Dr. Land, how do we preserve the beauty and importance of gender distinction? How do we fight against the social madness of a Target without falling into these very categories?
Well, we do it carefully. I certainly would agree that that the gender, the stereotypes of gender that we've had in American society are simplistic and often inaccurate. In my marriage, for instance, I'm the sensitive one. And my wife, yeah, I'm the one who says, well, if you have to ask what's wrong, you know, there's no use discussing it. And my wife's the mechanical one, and I'm not, you know, and I'm the romantic one, and she's not. I mean, these are surface things. But having had boys and girls as a father, they are different. Early playground behavior. There's been a lot of study done on early playground behavior, and what they found is that when boys are playing on the playground, the dynamic is who's up and who's down. And when girls are playing on the playground, it's who's in and who's out, which is a very different dynamic than who's up and who's down. I mean, boys tend to be more competitive. It's more about competition, and girls, it's who's in and who's out. It's more social. Now, there are always exceptions to every rule. You know, I mean, we're going to find guys that are more social and girls that are more competitive. But there are differences. And to say that there aren't any differences is, I think, destructive. It's denying a reality. And we really are practicing child abuse, emotional child abuse, when we tell our children that there are no differences that between boys and girls. I remember my most famous classmate, John Stossel. I was talking to him at the 25th reunion about his conversion to libertarian conservatism, because when I knew him, he was a very liberal guy. And he said, well, the beginning of it was when I started talking about sexual differences, and the feminists started attacking me and saying, you shouldn't talk about this, even if it's true. And he said, what started us on it, I had two sons, and we wouldn't let them have any warlike toys. And he said, my wife and I came home and found them sword fighting with cucumbers. And he said, well, you know, I mean, boys are different than girls.
Right.
And girls, you know, I've watched it. They want to play with dolls. Guys, little boys want trucks. They want stuff that makes noise. I remember one study I read recently where they did an experiment with two-year-olds. And they put the two-year-olds on one side of the room, and they put their mothers on the other side of the room, and they put about a two-foot barrier between them. The girls tended to, overwhelmingly, sit there and cry and reach out for their mothers. The little boys climbed over the barrier and went to their mothers. I mean, we're different, and God made us that way. And to deny, do we want to enshrine as biblical the American sexual stereotypes that have been traditional in our culture? No. But do we want to destroy all gender differences? Of course not.
Yeah, so Sarah, putting all that together, I would say better for Target to leave the gender distinctions in place and recognize it's still the world, and therefore you're going to have exaggerated stereotypes, and understand there can always be exceptions to the rules. But because of the larger message, it's much more important that we preserve gender distinctions. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Ken, you're on with Dr. Land.
Oh, hello, doctors, both of you. Oh, I realized, you know, when somebody said the movies that go overboard across seas, they enhance the porno and they dilute the aggression with the guns. Well, that's obvious. They want us to look like a degraded society, but not one that is involved in self-defense since the founders, and that we are a nation of those who have always been a gun society that has kept the other nine portions of the Bill of Rights going. Without the Second Amendment, the other nine would not exist.
Yeah, all right. And obviously that may be a more philosophical explanation than the reality of that Europeans aren't as entertained by it as we are. But
Or they're more shocked by it.
Yeah,
shocked. And I do think we've been desensitized to it. I mean, you look at popular entertainment, and it's, you know, think about Scarface, for instance. I mean, good grief. I mean, that movie was just horrific, you know, in terms of the violence. Now, look, I'm a Second Amendment guy. I grew up in Texas. You know, everybody's got a gun in Texas. And I believe in the right to keep and bear arms. And it's a fundamental right, and it helps to protect our freedoms. But I do think that we as a society have become obsessed with and desensitized mm-hmm. to violence in a way that we should be very concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole growing up in New York, son of a lawyer, I was never a gun handler. One of my sons is a hunter, and so it's just a different world and mindset. But that is a whole other culture, mm-hmm. a culture of violence. How do we respond? But Ken, thank you for the call. All right, Dawood, I want to get to your question next. And then, friends, if you live anywhere in greater Charlotte, North Carolina, then you probably know about the annual Apologetics Conference. But I want to invite you, listening wherever you are, all across America, October 16th and 17th. It is a premier event, the longest-running apologetics conference in the nation, kind of a who's who of speakers and subjects for the whole family, for homeschoolers, for intellectuals, for those that just want to be able to answer what the Bible says. And there's a pre-conference for women as well.
Fire we want, for fire we please.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I am in studio with Dr. Richard Land. Friend, take a minute, go to ses.edu. That's Southern Evangelical Seminary. ses.edu. I have the privilege of serving as an adjunct professor there as well. Their full-time faculty is tremendous. I hear great reports from colleagues of mine that have studied or do study there. And best of all, they have an extensive online program. 80% of their students now are online students. That's how popular that part of the school has become. Find out more about the school and the Apologetics Conference, October 16th and 17th. It is in Charlotte, North Carolina. People come from all over America to attend. So check it out. Find out about the online programs, bachelor's, master's, even doctoral programs, as well as introductory programs for those that are not interested in earning a degree at this point. All right, back to the phones. Our friend Dawood in Springwood, Virginia. Back in the States, are you now?
For 3 weeks. A little bit of R&R time, which is good. Get to spend some time with my wife.
And where are you being deployed otherwise?
Afghanistan.
So
well, thank you for your service.
You just got back from Afghanistan then?
Yes, I did. I was in the Marine Corps. Now I'm a government contractor. So what I do is, so my job sends me over and back from doing IT type stuff, cybersecurity and all that.
Wow.
Mrs. Clinton could use you.
Yeah. maybe a little too late. Dawood, we have limited time, so I wanted to make sure I got to your question for Dr. Land. Go ahead.
All right, Dr. Lamb. So my question to you regards, whenever a lot of time when we as Christians talk about our faith and why we believe what we do, almost always, at least in my experience, I get what's called the Bart Ehrman responses. It's like, well, how do you know the Bible is true? How do you mm-hmm. know that this was the original text and this and that? So my question is how do we as Christians defend against those types of Bart Ehrman responses? I hate to put it that way, but
yeah.
Well,
Bart Ehrman's fundamentally intellectually dishonest. You know, he talks about different variants and hundreds of different variants, and they're little tiny minor grammar things. The textual evidence for the accuracy and the authenticity of the New Testament text is without parallel. If you stack up the evidence for the textual transmission of the New Testament against any book prior to the invention of the printing press, it's like Mount Rushmore versus a molehill. And, nobody questions these other ancient sources. They don't question Herodotus. They don't question, the Roman histories, Pliny and others. They don't question Josephus.
Go back, we even think we have the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Well, that's right, the Iliad, the Odyssey. And we don't have, I'm telling you, it's like a molehill compared to Mount Rushmore. So I would start there, and I would just get a good, solid apologetics book, Dr. Geisler's book on Introduction to the Bible, along with Bill Nix or some others. And they give all of these evidences. Josh McDowell's books give these evidences in ways that you can just lay them out there. So like, here's the evidence. But then I would go on to say, how do you explain the flourishing and the survival of the Christian faith if it's not true? I go back to what the apostles had to know the truth. They lived lives where they were tortured, lives of privation, lives of martyrdom for something they knew was a lie? Of course not. They knew it was true because they experienced it, they witnessed it, they saw it. And it's hard to get around that fact. And it's hard to get around the fact that the Gospels were in circulation at the time, within the lifetime of the people who were there when the miracles took place, when the resurrection took place, when he spoke to 500 people at the same time and they all agreed on what he said. And they watched him go up into heaven.
Yeah, so, Delwood, there is so much. We've got to run time-wise, but happy to call. We'll let you on earlier than our normal time frame if you've got a follow-up question, and we'll try to get to it while you're back in the States. Do appreciate it. All right, Dr. Lamb, we've got very limited time. Out of the Republican presidential candidates, if you could pick one, who would it be?
Oh, well, first of all, all of them would be better than the current occupant, and all of them would be better than the current Democratic alternatives. Let me start there.
I agree.
If you ask me, okay, which one do you think? I'll answer this way: which one do I think would make the best president?
Right, whether they're electable or not.
Marco Rubio.
Okay, because
he's a strong believer. He's really smart. He gets it. He understands that elections are about the future and that we have to have 21st century solutions to 21st century problems, and we need to quit fighting over the 20th century battles with 20th century answers. He gets it. I just got to tell you, not only is he smart, really smart, but he's a wise man. For a man his age, he's a very wise man. He's a strong believer. Now, this is not saying that there aren't others who would do a great job,
right.
But you're asking me which one, if I could pick, I have the privilege of knowing most of these people, at least casually, and some of them more than casually, I would say to you, they all would do a better job than Barack Obama. They would all do a better job than Hillary or the current alternatives to Hillary. But if you ask me which one would make the best president of the United States, I would have to say Marco Rubio.
And do you think we've very limited time, so this is a soundbite of all soundbites. Do you think that the time could come where we have to find a third party because of the political establishment that seems to get in the way of real change?
No. Third parties never work. What happens is that if you have the impetus to a third party, what happens is when that reaches critical mass, the weaker of the two parties that are existing die and it's replaced. That happened with the Whig Party died because anti-slavery sentiment had reached critical mass and it was replaced by the Republican Party, which started out as a third party, became the second party, and 6 years after it was started, elected the greatest president the United States will ever have, Abraham Lincoln. If the Republican Party had not become the pro-life party in the wake of Watergate, when only 19% of Americans identified themselves as Republicans in 1974, if the Republican Party had not embraced the pro-life cause, then the Republican Party would have died and been replaced by a pro-life party. I think a third party movement could become a second party, but there won't be a third party candidate elected president ever. If there ever was going to be one, it would have been Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party in 1912, and all he succeeded in doing was electing Woodrow Wilson by splitting the Republican vote. If Donald Trump or someone else ran on a third party ticket, it would have the same effect that it had when Ross Perot did it. It would elect the Democrat president. Bill Clinton was elected twice by a minority, a significant minority of the popular vote, because he ran in a three-way race, and Ross Perot is responsible for Bill Clinton being elected president twice.
Got it. That was loud and clear. I wish, again, we had 20 hours or 200 hours, but just think. You can go to Southern Evangelical Seminary, where Dr. Land actually teaches. You can go to the Apologetics Conference. You can take online classes. You can join me for classes I've taught. Take them online as well. Find out about the Apologetics Conference, October 16th and 17th. You have our personal invitation to be there, ses.edu. My bottom line today, our goal here in America is not to go back to the good old days, but to go forward in a humble position before God, asking Him for mercy on our land.